see such a big turnout for our event tonight. I'm Barbara Postema. I'm a postdoctoral research fellow at the Modern Literature and Cultural Research Center. And I'll be introducing Trina, but first I wanted to say some thank yous. So thank you to the MLCRC and to Ryerson University for hosting us. Thank you for the MLC members, team members who helped me organize, Jason Wang, KT Russell, Esther Berry, Amanda Costco, Amy Smith, Megan Stahlberg, Walter Lai, and Shannon, missed her last name, sorry. And also thank you to Dr. Irene Gamel, the center's director, for her support. I would like to thank the Canadian Society for the Study of Comics, who are co-hosting this event with us, especially Glenn Wilmot, the Society President, and Calervis Nervo, and also the Toronto Comic Arts Festival, whose initiative it was to bring Trina Robbins to Toronto, and where she is a special guest. Ms. Robbins will also be appearing at the CSSC conference tomorrow as a keynote speaker, and on Saturday at TCAF. All different talks on different topics. So, comics historian and Will Eisner Hall of Fame inductee, Trina Robbins has had a long career in comics and knows all aspects of the form, having drawn, written, and published comics in addition to doing years of archival study. Ms. Robbins' focus has always been on women, from her first all-women underground comic book, It Ain't Me, Babe, in 1970, which carried the subtitle Women's Liberation, ongoing through anthologies like Women's Comics. Because besides working as a cartoonist, Robbins has always been very invested in supporting other women's inroads into the comics work. And so Women's Comics was conceived as a platform for new talent. She has promoted the involvement of women in comics in other ways, encouraging women to read and create comics through initiatives like Friends of Lulu, a nonprofit organization which she started with several other professionals in 1994. Robbins has switched to drawing to writing female-friendly stories, creating the series Go Girl, about a female superhero, and scripting Honey West, a comics adaptation of the noir detective series, as well as writing a Wonder Woman miniseries during the 1980s with Kurt Busiek doing the art. Robbins first wrote a historical overview of women in comics in the early 1980s, Women and the Comics, a collaboration with Catherine Ironwood. Yes. Since then, she has produced numerous histories, including The Great Women Superheroes, From Girls to Girls, The Great Women Cartoonists, Nell Brinkley, and The New Woman in the Early 20th Century, of course. She has also written a comic that throws a light on yet another another woman cartoonist called Lily Renee Escape Artist, a biography in comics form about a young Holocaust survivor who went on to become a Golden Age comic book artist. Robbins' work on comics, on women's comics history, has culminated recently with Pretty in Ink, North American Women Cartoonists, 1896 through 2013, which she says is her definitive statement on the matter. It was published last year by Fantagraphics. Another aspect of Robbins' historical work on women's comics is once more making available the work of female artists that has long fallen out of print. She has edited two volumes of Miss Fury, an epic adventure series from the 1980s by Tarpe Mills, which is on sale at the back, as well as Pretty in Ink, now published by IDW. And of course the collection The Brinkley Girls, the best of Nell Brinkley's cartoons, finally made available again. In honor of Trina's focus on women, all the materials out here today, the books and the pamphlets and things, are all by women cartoonists as well, from my collection. Tonight, Trina will present from her work on early 20th century cartoonist Nell Brinkley in a talk called The Brinkley Girls, World War I, and American Patriotism in Comics. Thank you.
The fact is, this is about much more than Nell Brinkley and World War I. In researching Nell Brinkley, I discovered so much that she, in general, had been very political. So although it includes World War I, there's a lot about her politics here. So I hope you won't be disappointed. Now, I'm heard told that if I tap this... Whoa, it did! Fantastic! Okay, this is Nell. Nell Brinkley came to New York to work for the Hearst Syndicate in 1907. She very quickly became a household name, became so popular that the Ziegfeld Follies, which was this annual musical show, always included a segment called the Brinkley Girls, in which pretty chorus girls and models would reenact Brinkley's art. And that tells you how aware people were of Brinkley's art, how familiar they were, that they could understand the reenactments. So most people tended to think of Nell Brinkley, and still do, as just, you know, an exquisite artist who drew beautiful women, and they were captioned. It was almost like commentary to her art. These were her dailies. She also did Sundays, which we'll come to later. Beautiful girls, kind of sentimental art, sentimental commentary down below. A lot of it. Beautiful men, too. So these are like typical daily Nell Brinkley strips. But in researching Nell Brinkley, I've come across that she did much more. She knew they wanted sentiment. She knew they wanted pretty girls. But there's so much more to her. Okay, The Whistle Blows. This is from 1913. And what these beautiful Brinkley girls are is they're shop girls. They're sales girls from the department stores going home from work at 6 o'clock. And this is what she writes. This is how she describes them. The girls who smile all day long, as steadily as any chorus girl is bidding to do, who haul down enough stuff in a day to tie a sash around this world, who try debutante dancing frocks on fat relics, whose too flat pay envelope is sometimes the fortune of the family, all those who need to earn a thicker pay envelope, all these bits of womanhood who go to make up the brave army that work in shops. So she's in 1913, she's already showing how sympathetic she was to the working woman and how sometimes they did indeed, take care of their whole family and who need to earn a thicker pay envelope. So she's speaking up for them. This is from 1910. It's earlier. What I did yesterday on my Saturday afternoon off. Now you have to understand what labor was like in those days. You worked. You worked for 6.5 days a week. You got Saturday afternoon off. You did not get Sunday off. The factories would have signs up that said, if you don't come in Sunday, don't come in Monday. So this is her afternoon off. This is her afternoon off. And look at them. They're at the Follies, you know. Look at them. They're very ethnic. Look at their noses. Look at their dark hair and her dark eyes. They're Italians or they're Jews. They're immigrants. The Brinkley girl wasn't always just this fluffy little rich girl. And she talks about working women in offices, professional women. This is from 1914, and this woman is Miss 1914. By the way, you can see that the office boy adores her just from the look on his face. But look at this. Miss 1914, real estate, doctor of medicine, lawyer, architect, chemist, broker, politician, scientist, consulting engineer, editor, and last of all, she's written voter. Now, women did not have the vote yet, not nationally, but certain states had given them the vote, and Nevada, in 1914, gave women the vote. And there's Cupid. She drew a lot of Cupids, and he's just sitting there smoking a cigarette with his he's just waiting. He's waiting for when she's ready for romance, but right now she's too busy. And this is when America did finally enter the war in 1917. Unfortunately, the caption is missing here, but this is Miss Liberty. Here's a woman in a military uniform. And last of all is a woman with the word suffrage being worn around her. And she is saying in this cartoon that if you care about liberty, that if you care about our women who are out there helping the military, helping the soldiers, then you must also care about suffrage. Is my water around? So, we entered the war in 1917. This is just about when she started doing her Sunday strips. And her Sunday strips were full pages, full page serials, and they were obviously inspired by the serials, by the silent movie serials, things like The Perils of Pauline, in which that had, female heroines who just cliffhangers, which would end on a cliffhanger, then you'd have to go next Sunday afternoon to see the next silent movie, chapter 2 in The Perils of Pauline. And this is what she did on Sundays. There's captions underneath it, but I'll tell you the story. Golden Ace and her hero, Bill. Okay, Bill is her fiancé, and he's gone off to fight the war. She is Golden Eyes. Bill has left her, as a parting gift, his collie. Someone has to take care of the dog. And she names him Uncle Sam. So this is very patriotic. And this is, it's in the poster. It's a special Buy War Bonds poster that she did for the newspaper. There she is in Nell Brinkley's idea of a military costume. And there's the ubiquitous Cupid down there. Okay. Uncle Sam uncovers a German spy lurking in her garden. So this inspires her that she has to do more than just sell war bonds. She goes overseas, she joins the Red Cross and goes overseas, and they let her take her dog. There they are. With Cupid, they let her take Cupid too. Once over there, she has a beautiful reunion with her fiancé. But of course it doesn't last because he has to go off and fight the war. And she becomes an ambulance driver for the Red Cross. Ah, this is I love this one. Talk about just emotional patriotism. She stops the ambulance because by the roadside are all these tired and wounded doughboys. As you can see with bandages, they're just tired, they're resting. She steps out and she sings. She sings to them the Star Spangled Banner. Look at her. So Nell really did, she mixed her patriotism with a lot of very dramatic sense. What's the word I want? Well, let's just say with drama. Okay, here comes the action. She crashes her ambulance in the woods. There's the wreck of the ambulance, and her, of course, her outfit is now fetchingly ripped, and who should come across her but a German officer, and he takes her prisoner. The dog escapes with her armband, her Red Cross armband, on which she has written a message. And of course, Uncle Sam is such a brilliant dog that he takes it right to the boyfriend, so the boyfriend can come and rescue her. But not before the German soldier almost shoots her. And here, after the rescue and everything else, he's back fighting, and she's back with the Red Cross. They're hiding in no man's land, and they're overhearing the German battalion making plans to attack her boyfriend's battalion. So they rush to warn them, but they're too late. There's been a battle, and she rescues her boyfriend, who has been wounded in the leg. In the snow, she drags him off to safety. And they all get medals, the dog too.
What about you?
Stayed behind. Now, in a rather really kind of unusual ending, because you would expect them to then go home and live happily ever after. Well, they do live happily ever after, but they stay in. Oh, wait, here's their military medic wedding, and of course the dog, too. They live happily ever after. Whoops, wait, how do we go back.
I'll do that.
I'll help. Thank you. They stay in France. They stay in France. He has to help put France back together again, wounded France. So they stay. And she actually opens an abandoned chateau for war orphans. Okay. So this was her first, really her first serial. She did a number of them, but this is actually my favorite because it's got so much action and sentiment. All right, so what happened? We all know that what happened in World War II. We know that the guys went off to fight and women took their places in various industries. Well, the same thing happened in World War I. We don't know as much about that. She did a series called Girls Who Work for Uncle Sam. A whole series. This is one of them. Miss Mildred Morris, Department of Agriculture. And they were working in Washington, D.C., of course, in the offices, taking over the jobs that, you know, never before had there been a woman working in the Department of Agriculture. But the women weren't always treated as well as they should. This is Uncle Sam's schoolgirl shower. Uncle Sam's girl shower, I'm sorry. Nell, as I said, was very sentimental, and she wrote very sentimentally. But then you have to hear what she's saying. She's pleading for these young women. They all came to Washington to work. But then they found out, you can't read this, but it says apartments, no dogs, children, or girls. They couldn't find homes, because in those days, boarding houses would not rent to single young women, figuring they all must be prostitutes, right? So this is what she writes. She says, "What you going to do about them, Uncle Sam? The eager little daughters of your own red blood who are falling in on you at Washington at your call to be your clerks and help you win the war? You going to let them curl up on park benches to spend their first night in your great white town? You going to let them run into the barbed wire entanglement of a glaring apartment house sign that says, 'Apartments to let. No dogs, no children, and no young ladies.' When are you going to put up a barracks, as you do for your other soldiers?" Which, of course, they never did do. But, you know, she cares about these women. And here's another one that she did about the young women who went to work in Washington. Uncle Sam's little schoolgirls. She says, "Don't you think, as I think, that they deserve good pay, those little clerks, and a pension, after Uncle Sam is through with them and they with him, after good years of service, so that if the dream they all dream of, a home and a man and a child, does not come true, his schoolgirls will be taken care of." Imagine, 1917, and she's asking for a pension. These women were not pensioned, of course. Now, they were not paid very well, as you would expect. Okay, after the war was over, the veterans had been promised a bonus, that they would get a certain amount of money, something that in those days was a large amount of money, in 1945, after the war. But then along came the Depression. And have you ever heard here of the Bonus Army? No, this is an American thing. The government, as I say, promised the veterans that they could have a bonus in 1945. All right, it's 1932. It's the Depression. They don't have any work. They say, "We want our bonus now. We need it now." But the government wouldn't give it to them. So they marched on Washington, the Bonus Army. They all drove into Washington. You know, and with their wives and kids, they had families. And they built a little shanty town right in front of the White House, and they called it Hooverville. And they were very badly treated. I have to tell you that, you know, the government never gave in to them. At this point, Hoover was the president, and he was not a good person. He gave orders. The famous General MacArthur, who was such a World War II hero, commanded troops that burned them out, tear gassed them, and burned their huts. And this is what she says. And you notice that a hand is pulling the pretty wrinkly girl off the stage and says, "Come, my dear pretty girl, no one is interested in you just now." She says, "You and I remember when he wore a more jaunty uniform than he does today in Washington. But to most of the American public, he is just as much our soldier as he was in those hysterical days. He was a patriot then, and he is showing by a peaceful, wholly American attitude that he is still one. It has taken courage to take this long trek to Washington. We watched him one winter day leave his country 10,000 strong. We cheered and wept and bought bonds and backed him up with all our hearts. And of course, she's also talking about her. This is what she did because she really believed in it. She believed in the soldiers. She believed in the cause. We, you know, today we know that there wasn't really much of a cause and it was pretty pathetic, all these people throwing their lives away. But this is what she says. We backed him up with all our hearts. I remember, she says, the public still backs him up. Will our government let him be a needy American? So she got pretty disenchanted with the government. But then Roosevelt was elected, and everything turned around. And she was one of the people who adored Roosevelt, even more so, of course, because she related to women. She adored Eleanor. So this is 1934, okay? And America is starting to recover. And this is from a series, Miss America Sees Washington, D.C. This is number 9 in the series. These two girls, who she calls Miss America, go to Washington. They have tea. They see all the wonderful new things that are happening. And they have tea with Eleanor Roosevelt. And Nell Brinkley did. She had tea with Eleanor Roosevelt. And this is her way of telling the story. She adored Eleanor Roosevelt. And you can see, by the way, that she was also... Eleanor never looked that good. So I'm going to end it. I'm going to go back in time, back to 1928. I'm going to end it with one of her Sunday pages. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm not ending it yet. I forgot about her Woman Warrior series. This is great. She did this in the later 30s, I think, 37. And you can also see, by the way, that her style has changed a bit. It has changed through the years. So at this point, it's got that kind of 1940s magazine look to it, but it's still absolutely identifiably Nell Brinkley. And she did a series called Heroines of Today, Women Warriors. And this is a woman who dressed in a man's outfit and masquerading as a man in Spain, fought in the Spanish Civil War. You know, if you look at the way she's drawn her, it's really hard to believe that they actually believed she was a man. But that's Nell, you know, because she can't draw a woman who is not beautiful. And then in the end, kind of sadly, there she is. The war's over. She's a housewife. She's peeling potatoes. But she remembers. Another one in the series, Quick Trigger Woman. This is a plainclothes policewoman. And she arrests the guy, and the guys, bad guys, and they're all embarrassed because they were caught by a woman. And she's got a medal down there that she's pinning on her head. And in the end, she relaxes at night with a good mystery. Another one. I love the Forest Wardeness. I like that. I love the way they would add S to the end of things to make them female. But here's one who spots a fire. Reports the fire. She's a warden, forest warden. Reports the fire to the aviator and works, you know, on putting out the fire. Real heroines, 1937. Okay, I believe that now we're going to go back 10 years to 1928. Yes, Dimples Daydreams, and it's all very cute. She did this whole series in the '20s that were just very cute and very charming and were flappers. But look, what she is imagining. And the boyfriend wishes she would stop imagining and just marry him. But what she is imagining is that she goes into politics. And you can see her there, you know, giving her speech. And finally, in the end, she's running for mayor there. In the end, she says, why not elected mayor or governor? Or, what a whopping wow, why not be even president? A gal where Cal is now. Cal was Calvin Coolidge. And look at her. You know, she's president in a pantsuit, in a Hillary Clinton, her version of a Hillary Clinton. was only 8 years after women finally got the vote. So that's my political now. I think that's it. And I have so many answers to your questions. You do have questions. Yes?
Many of those early drawings look like engravings. Did she actually...
She must have used the world's thinnest crow quill pen. And she used many, many lines. She had a very delicate, extremely delicate line. They're not engravings.
No, but they certainly look like engravings. And did she do the lettering as well?
Oh, she did everything, yes. Yeah. I can recognize her lettering, in fact, because later she did a children's book, and it's completely hand-lettered by her.
Oh.
Someone else? Yes?
Her appeal seems to be very broad in terms of she appealed to women because she spoke to their hopes and dreams and aspirations, but also to men because she showed that glamorous side.
Oh, yes. Mm. Oh, yeah. And men liked her, too. But, you know, really, her largest audience was women. And young women also, women of all ages. But girls, teenage girls, used to, yeah, I think some grown women also, used to, the black and white illustrations, they would color them. They would clip them out and put them in scrapbooks, and that makes it sometimes very hard to find work by Nell Brinkley because it's been colored and pasted in scrapbooks. And I have some of those. I have some that have been colored. And I even have some that have been copied, because that's the other thing. The young girls would copy her pictures because they were so pretty. Yes? Yeah, you first. Okay. Superman.
All right. You read some quotes from Nell Brinkley. Where are they from?
Oh, they're from, they were the quotes that were under the pictures.
Okay.
Because I told you it was commentary. And that was her commentary. You can read it better in the book, but I had to read it to you because it's very hard when it's on a screen. And Superman.
Oh, one of the things that I noticed that you didn't comment on, was this is a very long career. We started, I believe, in 1907,
yes.
And the latest one you mentioned was 1934. So she's quite famous, quite successful for a very, very long time.
Yes.
So I'm curious, and this is sort of addresses a lot of things that you talk about across your career, why don't we remember her? Or is it just my ignorance? But
no,
was this stuff suppressed, or was it erased from the record, or what?
All right,
do you think?
The biggest discovery I made when researching women cartoonists is that if you are not written about, you are forgotten.
Hmm.
And that's what happened to Nell, because most of the histories, until I kind of came along, most of the histories of comics were written by men, and they simply didn't include the women. Some of them might like take two pages and say, oh yeah, there were some women too, and here are some small, insignificant pictures of their work. But that's it. That's it. When I started researching Nell, I had really very, very bad references. This was in the days, I'm talking about the 80s, the days before, you know, the internet, and it was very hard to find information. Most people just thought of her as, you know, she just drew these pretty pictures, these lovely little sentimental pictures. They hadn't really read what she wrote. So they, you know, some of the references that I did have, that I did find, for instance, there was a Los Angeles group that was... It was basically a bunch of fans and collectors of early 20th century illustrations. And they had a section on Nell, and everything they wrote was wrong. They even had her hair color wrong. They said that she was a Republican. I can't believe it when I show you things like this, that she was ever a Republican. I got it completely wrong, completely wrong. What started me, okay, this is a story of magic. This is a story of serendipity. In 1993, when I got my first computer, and, you know, finally was able to tune in on the internet, someone forwarded a letter to me, an email. And I know the woman who forwarded it to me, but she can't remember where she found it. And it said, my mother was an Nell Brinkley fan all her life, and she collected her work. And now she has passed away. I would like to get this work to someone who knows and cares about Nell. Well, I replied immediately. I said, I know Nell Brinkley, you know. But then I said, I have to warn you, you know, and I will write about her. I've been writing about her. I have to warn you that as a writer, I'm not very rich. I can't pay much. And she emailed me back immediately and said, I wouldn't dream of asking for any money. I just want to get this into the right hands. And then, she could have been anywhere in the world. We're talking about email. She lived about 20 minutes car drive. She drove the collection out to me. Collection neatly put, not pasted, but neatly put between plastic sleeves and scrapbooks about this thick. And going through them, I suddenly realized, oh, she didn't just draw pretty girls. I mean, that would have been enough because they're pretty. But look what she's saying. Look what she says. And no one somehow had ever noticed that before. And I did write a book in which I talk about it, which is back in my hotel room. But I will be bringing copies of the book tomorrow.
Good. Thank you.
You're welcome. Yes?
Me?
Yes.
Oh, it's obvious that she was super influenced by like current fashion. Did she ever influence fashion also? Like, did it ever go vice versa?
Well, you know, we'll never know. But you know, she certainly could have been a fashion designer. You look at the clothes she puts her heroines in, and they're gorgeous. They're gorgeous. So you know, I'd like to. I'm not a good enough seamstress, even though I do sew. I'd like to find a real genius and pick out one of Nell's costumes and have her make it for me. Yes?
Was her work regionally or nationally?
Nationally.
And it
even went to England.
Wow.
And in fact, no, I'm sorry. I'm sure it was in Canada, but I don't have any proof of that. But I know it was reprinted in England. Yes?
Is there any evidence she was as well paid as her fellow male cartoonists?
I don't have any evidence, but I suspect that she was. She was a superstar.
Because Charles Dana Gibson and people like that were paid a fortune, relatively speaking.
Yeah, well, Gibson, of course, I would say that she was paid as well as the Hearst cartoonists. I don't know about Gibson. But the Hearst cartoonists, she was one of Hearst's favorites. He, as you know, or may not know, he had a film company. You know, he started the film company to make films starring his mistress, Marion Davies, who really, no, you know, you should see her movies. She's very good. She's a fabulous comedian, and she was quite beautiful. But he made a movie called The Great White Way, which at this point is probably still one of the great lost films, silent films. But in it, he put all his favorite cartoonists who worked for the Hearst Syndicate. And I have a photo in my book in which you can, all the famous ones, McManus, you know, all of them. I can't think of the names, but all of them. And the only woman is Nell. So she was definitely his star. Yeah?
Have you ever tracked down any original works of hers?
Oh, God, yes, of course. I have original work by her that is currently on exhibit at the San Francisco Cartoon Art Museum, but has traveled all over the world. I've had exhibits. I have the largest collection of original comic art by early 20th century women cartoonists. And the reason I have it is because none of the guys want it. They were looking for Spider-Man number one. So I have this stuff. And it's wonderful, you know. And it's been exhibited in Japan and Germany and Spain and all over the world, really. And you know, all over America, too, in New York and Philly. But not Philly, Pittsburgh. I just got it back from Pittsburgh. But right now it's at the Cartoon Art Museum, and it's the largest, because I have so much. I usually just show chunks, you know. So this is the largest chunk of my collection that's been shown yet, if you can find your way to San Francisco. It's on exhibit through August. Yes, Ken?
Were the originals, some of the originals in full color in the Rotogravure here, or were they mechanically colored?
They were mechanically colored, but the Library of Congress, you know that beautiful one of her selling war bonds? She painted that in after it was printed, and the Library of Congress has it. Mm. And when it went up for sale, I can tell you that my partner Steve and I were going like, how much could we afford? We figured maybe $1,000, $2,000. They bought it for $5,000. And hey, you know, it's in the Library of Congress. That's okay. Yeah.
You probably would have donated to them anyway.
That's why I died.
I know
were on Nell Brinkley hair curlers or bob curlers, you know, which was the curls with the short hair that they had. And the packages were really great because there was a whole thing on them of how what you can do with your hair, how you can make it look like, you know, the Brinkley characters, and it was signed Nell Brinkley. It was like she had written this. Yeah. I doubt it, seriously, but, you know, obviously they paid a lot of money just to get her signature on these.
Yeah. I was wondering if she got any royalties from that.
Oh, I'm sure.
Any other merchandise that from that period, like late 1910s, early 20s, was so big on merchandising of, like, various, like, celebrities and people of note.
I'm pretty sure she did. She lived well. She lived in New Rochelle at the same time as, it was an artist's colony. Lyon Decker lived there. Norman Rockwell lived there. If you were an artist and you lived in New Rochelle, you had arrived. So she was doing quite well. She had a stable and horses. You know, the whole thing. Yeah.
If I might follow up on the last thing, it makes perfect sense that the historians, mostly men, just sort of wrote her out of the record. I'm wondering if we have any records of other artists at the time who remembered her, or letter exchanges or anything like that, especially since she lived in a place that's full of artists.
Well, she had a really interesting obit when she died in 1944 in, what was it, the National Cartoonist Society newspaper or newsletter, I'm not sure. I could look it up because it's in my book. And it was interesting also because she died, the same year that she died, Rose O'Neill died. And Rose O'Neill was older than Nell. She had done the first comic in 1896. I found that comic. Wow. And it's the first comic, documented comic by a woman cartoonist. She made her fame, of course, during the QBs. Well, the article says that Nell Brinkley had more copyists than Charles Dana Gibson, and that, along with Rose O'Neill, who had died that year also, she was very beautiful. She was, I think they said she was an Eiffel.
Any more questions?
You'll have copies of this book?
I think there are copies. Are there copies back there? No, there aren't.
It's out of print.
But you can find her in Pretty and Ink. And tomorrow I am bringing some copies of the biography I wrote about her, which is a black and white, smaller book, mm-hmm. black and white. But I think that you'll find some of her work in, I know you'll find her work in Pretty and Ink. And if you can ever, you know, try Amazon.com for Brinkley Girls because it's out of print. Yeah.
If I could change the subject slightly, it was fascinating to read that you were a character in Joni Mitchell's Lady of the Canyon song. And I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about that time and place and those people.
That's going to be in my memoir, which I'm writing right now. It's going to be published by Kitchen Sink, who is at this point part of Dark Horse. So just be patient. Yes?
What happened? Like, did she have any letters or papers? And what happened to them after she died?
I don't. This woman, this wonderful woman, Althea Lettiller, who collected all her stuff and then passed away, and I got it, she did include in one of the scrapbooks, she included a lot of newspaper articles about Nell, which is another way that I know so much, that I know that, for instance, that she had tea with Eleanor Roosevelt. But she didn't include any letters. So, I doubt if she had any letters to include. I doubt if she found them.
Thank you. I think we'll
thank you. Thank you so much.
Have more.